Nate Hedgie is a rural reporter for the Mountain West News Bureau. And back in August, he set out for a long trip across the Continental Divide. The idea was to talk to Westerners along the way, see how they were feeling about the election, see if he could understand their overwhelming support of Donald Trump and how politics was affecting their communities and their relationships. He wanted to get close, and that meant he had to slow his pace. So he ditched the idea of a car, and he took his bike.
When you're on a bicycle, you have so much time just to think. You're just riding really slowly and sweating and bored. Can't listen to music, really, because you've got to have at least one ear open to hear highway traffic, and so there's just a lot of time to think. The Lemhi Valley is pretty empty country, so you don't see many people. I remember it was mid-morning, and I was riding up this highway towards a place called Gilmore. And when I get to the top, I see this tiny little plastic American flag. And the wind's blowing really, really hard. And that flag, it's in tatters, bleached by the sun, nearly destroyed by the wind. It was barely an American flag anymore. And it felt to me like a very apt metaphor for where we were as a country. This country feels very broken down right now. We are having a hard time agreeing on even a set of facts. And there's a feeling of being lost in the wilderness as a country. It feels very frayed. And we're really struggling to find common ground with each other. So I decided to literally just take my bicycle out of my shed below my house and start riding. That's how we experienced this landscape before the automobile was at that speed of around 10 to 12 miles per hour. It's like someone on horseback. I wanted to really feel the immensity of this landscape. And I wanted to meet more people too.
Did you have an operating thesis going into this? Like this idea that, you know, there's a lot that divides us as a country, but part of that division seems artificial. Division that, as you put it in one of the episodes, it's a curated glimpse that people see on the news. It's not real.
I knew that, obviously, as most Americans know, that we are really struggling to find common ground these days. But I didn't want to make that the focus necessarily of my conversation outside of the fact that I was riding along the Continental Divide. You know, whether that made them think about the political divide, I don't know. But I really tried not to go in with a hypothesis other than just to listen.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're getting some thoughts on this election season from the rural West. And we're going to begin with Nate Hedgie, who's back home now. He's turned his trip into an audio essay, a podcast he's called Facing West. Nate says he didn't go out with any sort of a hypothesis to test. He just wanted to see what he found by talking, you know, chatting people up. But given that rural America has been such an important source of support for Donald Trump back in 2016 and now, this week, he was hoping to understand why.
I mean, I'd be lying if I didn't want to really know that, you know. And I think some of those, the hypotheses came after I started riding, really, you know, because the first thing you notice as soon as you exit Missoula and you go down into the Bitterroot Valley, which is, you know, Missoula's kind of more conservative neighbor, is the sheer amount of blue Trump 2020 flags that start popping up. And you can't help but notice that there is a passion for President Trump that I haven't seen in those kind of communities for a different politician before. And so after a couple of days of seeing that and speaking with people, I really began to get curious about why people were so excited about President Trump.
Did you have any great insight that answered that question, why it was people in the rural West in particular who, look, let's be honest, have almost nothing in common with a multimillionaire real estate developer slash reality star from the East Coast?
There's this guy I met in Ledore, Idaho, Dave. We were chatting and he said the same thing.
There is no one here in this area and virtually in this county that is not a Trump supporter, either to a greater or lesser degree. And I have to be honest, I don't understand that. He does not represent the values of the people that are out here. And anyone that thinks that a billionaire is the friend of the common man is pretty much short-sighted.
He was the only Republican that I met in Ledore who wasn't a fan of the president. He was also one of the only people that didn't watch Fox News or listen to conservative talk radio. And I think that that plays a huge, huge role in how people perceive Trump, as well as Trump's own myth-making. You know, again and again, I heard the same thing. He's a businessman. He can't be bought. But I think the biggest thing that rings true is that he's not a politician. Mm-hmm. And I think that what I saw was a distrust of government and outsiders trying to tell us how to manage our lives. And Trump taps into something.
Yeah.
He taps into a feeling that, like, hey, I'm with you guys. Like, yeah, this is all kind of BS.
Did you find anything that was even more personal than that?
You have to recognize that the West is changing. I mean, the West's always been changing, right? But especially in the past few years, if you live in a pretty part of the West, you're seeing a big influx of new residents moving to your town. And I think there's a real concern of the outsider. And I think what Donald Trump and the modern Republican Party tap into really well is we're not going to change anything. We're going to bring jobs back. We're going to bring it back to the way it was. And I think that people really respond to that idea. We're going to preserve conservative values, and your conservative Western values is something that I heard a lot.
This comes up in the conversation you have with a man by the name of Ben Bartow. He's in Du Bois, Wyoming, makes knives, born and raised there in Wyoming, is an artist. He makes these Trump flags and these banners. And I wanted to just ask you a little bit about your conversation with him, because it goes to this idea that you were saying before, that what's appealing about Donald Trump for him, he says, is that Trump isn't a politician, that he turned around the economy because he's this really good businessman. And the thing that really stood out for me in your conversation with Ben was this idea that Ben was convinced by what he was hearing in conservative media, particularly Fox News, and he cops to that. He listens to a lot of Fox News, he says, is that liberals aren't just different. They hate America.
I ask Bartow where he hears all this stuff.
Fox News.
Fox News. A lot of people watch it out here. And it's interesting. That channel uses the word hate 5 times more often than the other news networks. As in, the Democrats hate America. The media hates Trump. And Bartow, like a handful of other people I meet on this trip, he thinks it's all going to end in revolution.
You think so?
I do. I think it's headed there. You know, the people are now waking up. They're tired of seeing what's going on in the cities burning under Democratic rule. Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter, they aren't the only ones that matter. The Black Lives Matter is the most racist, progressive movement out there. And they're the cause of the destruction that's going on right now.
If you were to watch Fox News to the level I think that he watches it and a few other folks that I spoke with watch it, it's very easy to believe that the Democratic Party is the party that hates America. And it creates this weird disparity, because I'll be talking with Ben Bartow and he says that we're headed towards a revolution.
Yeah.
And there's going to be violence or civil unrest. But then at the same time, you know, he'll talk about He was an extremely kind and generous and open guy to me, a member of the media, you know, a member mm-hmm. of quote unquote fake news.
Yep.
And he'll talk about how, you know, we need to find common ground and we need to, you know, come together. And, you know, the beautiful thing about communities like Du Bois is that people help each other out here. You know, if there's a power outage or a snowstorm, you can rely on your neighbor, no matter what their politics or everything else like that, you know. But then there's this fear of this kind of vague outsider, this villain, you know, protesters in the streets of Portland or Kenosha, hundreds, if not thousands of miles away from where he is, that's, you know, proving to be a threat to his way of life. It was a very confusing conversation. And I felt like we were just going around and around in circles.
I wanted to ask you about a conversation you had with a man named Jesus Archuleta. He and his friend, both Latino, and this really interested me because they're Latino, but they're also conservative. And this is a group that seems to have played a role in the election that has surprised a lot of people, despite, you know, the president's immigration policies and his language speaking about immigrants. Many Latino people have turned out to be Trump supporters, like Jesus, for example. And I wondered what you made of that.
The communities I went through were majority white, for sure.
Yeah.
But I think there's something to be said about fitting in and a way of life and kind of values that glue people together, no matter whether you're Black, Hispanic, white, whatever. And Jesus Archuleta and his cousin Lucas Medina, two guys that I met in Rawlins, you know, they fit that mold.
He's lived in Rawlins for most of his life. It's an oil town, so he loves that President Trump champions fossil fuels. And just like Ben Bardo, he's also worried about the protesters in big cities.
I think, personally myself, I think they're a terrorist group.
And if Trump gets reelected, he wants him to clean house.
And I'm not saying annihilate him, I said, but stop him. Treat him like a terrorist group and get him out of there. You know, and that's, you know, and make him pay for what they're doing. You know, if they're destroying people's homes and buildings and burning everything down, I think they should pay.
I ask him if he understands why people in cities might protest police violence.
Well, most of the people that protest aren't people from them cities. They're, like I said, they're hired by these lefties. But anyway, they're hired by these people that have all these big bucks going in there in cities to destroy them.
Where did you hear that?
On the media. You see them. They catch them. You see them in the media. They go down. They bring them in on buses. You know? They bring them in on buses to come in and protest.
Do you get your news from, like, where do you get your news from? Social media or?
Mostly Fox News and watching TV and, you know, Facebook. But TV, like you said, you know, all over. But you see them guys coming through and you see them getting off the buses in some of the pictures, you know. I mean, a person's not even safe to go into town and without somebody coming to tip your car over and break the windows.
They very much fit into the dominant culture of the rural West. They own guns. They believe in self-sufficiency. They work in the trades. And in Jesus's experience, he also watches a lot of Fox News. His cousin doesn't really watch news whatsoever, but they come to similar conclusions in terms of reasons why they like Trump. So Rawlins is an oil town.
Yeah.
And, you know, Trump and a majority of the modern Republican Party have been strong champions of the fossil fuel industry. And so when your town kind of rides or dies on fossil fuels, you want to have somebody in that's going to reduce regulations and try as hard as they can to help prop up your industry. And so that played a big role into why he liked the president.
Nate Hedgie, he's a reporter for the Mountain West News Bureau. His podcast is called Facing West. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER connects you to your community and brings you the facts about what's happening across our state. As part of our service-driven mission, we value your input. What issues should our reporters be covering where you live? Whose stories should we be telling? Do you have a question about a program or a story you heard on the station? By answering a few short questions, you can help us improve our statewide service. Consider leaving your feedback at KUER.org. www.radiowest.org/feedback.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the journalist Nate Hedgie. He covers small rural communities for the Mountain West News Bureau. And back in August, he began a bike trip that covered hundreds of miles along the Continental Divide. He says he was hoping to slow down and really listen to people who are dealing with a constantly changing West and a divided nation. He has a podcast he's produced called Facing West. What difference does it make, Nate, talking to people in person?
I think it makes a huge difference in terms of recognizing people as people and not as something that you've seen through a computer screen or your smartphone or a television. There's a woman I met in just outside of, I think it was Riverside, Wyoming, near the Colorado border, Sharon Martinson. And she kind of offhandedly, she was a census worker, but she was kind of just offhandedly mentioned this Mark Twain quote that essentially says that travel is the antidote to bigotry and prejudice.
Maybe you've seen this too, about meeting tons of people. Mark Twain said it's like, you know, travel is the antidote to that. And meeting so many people who look different, do different things, act different, and then just being like, oh yeah, you're also human, just like me.
I think there's something to be said about that, for sure. I think that when we push ourselves outside of our bubble and we have conversations with folks, we can recognize them as simply as just being another human being, another face. And yeah, there is a connection that happens when you're just talking with somebody. And we're losing that we're definitely losing that right now during the pandemic. But I think we've been kind of slipping away from that for a while. And just looking them in the eye and recognizing that they may be saying something that's not true. They may be saying something that's coming wildly different than your own perspective. And you're just like, how can this person believe this? But you can also just find common ground as another human being, you know, trying to make it in this world.
Is it empathy?
Yeah, I think so, for sure. It's definitely empathy. And I think it's much, 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 much easier to have empathy with someone when you meet them and have a conversation with them than when they're on the other side of some kind of digital divide.
Let's talk a little bit more about the other part that seemed to interest you, not just the way people were thinking, you know, about the, you know, political landscape, but your interest in how the West was changing. Gentrification, for example, you know, as you say, growth and costs that people are having to encounter. Let's talk a little bit about Sierra McAdams. Works the register at a fly shop in Salmon, Idaho. You sort of pegged her as an urban exile, and for sure that was right. She's from Boise. And I wanted to ask you about the conversation you have with Sierra, because she talks about something you must have heard a good bit in your travels, this idea of the preserving the traditions or preserving the rituals or of community of these small towns.
I respect what the government is here. I respect the economy, what people are trying to do here, and they're trying to preserve it, and that's what I want to do. And by no means am I a wealthy person. I'm 25 and, to be honest, dirt poor. And so the effect that I have is really not that big when it comes to the growth of Salmon, Idaho.
When you say preserving, what do you think? I hear that word come up a lot in my conversations. Kind of, how do you define preserving what salmon is?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's kind of mixed, because some people could be like, well, this is an old Republican town and, you know, we want it to stay that way. And it's like, you know, I can see that to an extent. Like, there's a lot of people who want that to stay the same. But I want, if anything, like, I want the small town feeling, that old Wild West feeling to stay the same, where you can hop in your vehicle and you can go park on the side of the road anywhere and go sleep, or you can walk out your back door and go hike wherever you want. And I think Salmon is just this gem of a town, and not a lot of people know about it, and I want it to stay that way. But unfortunately, that's not going to happen in the world that we live in. You know, it's a rapidly growing world we are in.
Her idea was open spaces, that beauty of being able to drive your truck down a, you know, an old logging road on some Forest Service land and just camp wherever you want to, you know, having access to rivers and streams that you can walk down and fly fish, you know, and that kind of freedom that she wanted to preserve. Even though she wasn't from that area, she felt like she fit in that sense that she also respected those open spaces and those public lands. At the same time, she was really afraid. You know, you have a handful of big ranches around salmon, and as you do all around the West, and there have been, you know, more and more, it feels like, very wealthy people purchasing those ranches, in some cases, you know, blocking access through their private parcels to public lands, and just changing the feel of a town. And that's what she was worried about, because she had seen that happen in the foothills of Boise a little bit, and bringing in, you know, people with different kinds of values maybe, and the fear that would also lead to housing prices getting jacked up and a town becoming unaffordable for her again.
You say that growth and change are constants in the West. You must have found that everywhere.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, growth and change have been constants in the West since, you know, at least for the past two centuries, since white settlers really began landing out here and pushing out indigenous tribes. We're always changing. And it's funny because we're always kind of digging our heels in the mud on change out West and preserving a way of life that maybe only existed for a couple of decades. I mean, you look back to some of these towns, you know, I look back at my hometown of Missoula in the 80s when we had a sawmill and there was a lot of you know, smoke in the air and everything else like that, and a totally different kind of, way more blue collar workers here than you look at it now, and it's, you know, a college town with remote workers, and that was a change over 20, 30 years, you know. Mm. We're always changing.
Let's talk about Jody Burnside. Owns a restaurant, a construction company, does pretty well. He's seeing a lot of this change, and he seems, in your conversation with him, kind of conflicted about it, and it brings up that kind of watchword that you hear in the West, a lot of these communities, about people being worried about the Californians coming
right.
in.
Right.
California attitudes, like, what do they make of the Californians and how are they talking about them?
Well, California is a swear word out West, I think, you know, right? It's like, you could look at Salt Lake City and California is a dirty word. It's a dirty word in Missoula. It's a dirty word everywhere. And I think it's code for outsider, right? Mm-hmm. There's always a feeling like, oh, these Californians are coming. They're going to bring their liberal policies with us, their liberal politics. They're also going to bring their wealth. So, you know, Jody is very concerned about that. At the same time, he's making money from these folks because he's a developer.
You know, I grew up here in the mountains, hunting, fishing, living off the land, not living off, you know, like TV and money, like I said, and government was nothing, no part of our life. We were free. We do whatever we want. The changes that happen here is they block off the roads.
He's talking about wealthy people moving in, buying up ranches, and blocking off access to public lands for people who've lived in this valley for generations.
You know, we made those trails when we were kids. We rode those mountains and cleaned those trails. And to go up there now, it's like I'm a bad guy.
How do you square that, you know, because you are seeing that growth and the change, right? Like the change in those mountains that you grew up as a kid and everything else like that. Same time, you're making like good money off of those folks coming in and everything else like that. How do you square that? I mean,
what do you mean? How do you figure that?
Well,
I make no money off of them.
Well, no, the growth and everything else like that, right? Like people moving in here.
Well, you know, the thing with that is you got to either grow with it or get out of it, you know, and a lot of people don't know how to grow with it. So people like us that do development, do business and stuff like that, we're all for it. But we see the other side of it as well. It raises our taxes, it raises our schools, it raises different problems as we go along.
But at the end of the day, Burnside accepts that here, under the shadow of the Teton Mountains, growth is inevitable.
You got to be able to change with it, or you always just get left behind, you know?
There's this idea that you keep coming back to throughout the piece, I think to your credit, where you acknowledge it's probably easy for you to sort of go around because you're white. You look like you, even though you're wearing spandex, you might fit in. You might be of a like mind. But what about those who don't fit in? And let's maybe start with Carrie Davey.
Davey was born and raised here in Rawlins, Wyoming. But she doesn't look the part. She's got a nose ring, hip yellow glasses, tattoos on her wrist and knuckles. She works as a sous chef at a local restaurant.
Just yesterday, so I go out in the dining room and someone's like, "You look like a criminal." And so
for her, you know, she doesn't, what I experience is kind of that, what I think a lot of folks really pride themselves on is neighborliness and being kind to strangers and nice to strangers and open to them. She doesn't experience that. She experiences, you know, she doesn't think people are so kind. And she even goes so far as to say, you know, that idea that neighbors helping neighbors when there's a snowstorm or a power outage, regardless of race, politics, you know, gender, whatever. She doesn't think that's about being kind. She thinks it's about survival.
Everybody always says everything's so far apart here. If you don't stop and help them, they could die. Like, that's what my mom and dad have told me my whole life. You have to stop and help people because it's so far apart from anyone and no one could drive by them for hours. And so I feel like that's like a whole different thing.
Right. Okay.
It's like not so much being nice, but if you don't help this person, they will die.
So there's not necessarily a friendly, it's like, we don't want someone to die.
Exactly. So like, it's just like a general goodness. Like I don't think people here are super kind.
That was, to me, one of the most novel insights in the whole piece. Her saying, yeah, we get along in these small communities, but it's not because we love each other necessarily, or it's not because of the fact that we, you know, have this wonderful, noble communal idea. It's just because we don't want to see them die, because this is a pretty intense environment. And so that I thought that was so interesting.
I did too. Yeah. I thought it was really interesting. And I'd not heard that before. There was a guy, I'm going to point back to him, Dave in Ledore, Idaho, you know, who called Ledore, you know, a disjointed family. But when the cards are down, we're going to help each other out, you know, even though we might disagree on everything. And so, I mean, I'm not one to say, you know, whether it's survival or kindness, but I thought it was fascinating that that was her perception. And I think it was a little bit of Dave's perception as well, is that we're going to help each other out, even though we may hate each other's guts sometimes. We're going to help each other out because we have to be self-sufficient. We don't have those kind of government services to help us out when the chips are down.
I wanted you to say something about the two African students you encountered in the Mormon community of Rexburg, Idaho. That was an interesting conversation you had.
I'm riding my bicycle through the Mormon college town of Rexburg, Idaho, when I spot Mashike Elizabeth Lumbama and her friend Wendile Sabisi. They're walking down the street wearing gym clothes, two black women in this majority white town.
I feel like people are... they're not genuinely polite. They act polite, but they're not.
Lumbama and Sabisi are international students from South Africa and Zaire. It's been a bumpy transition moving to Rexburg.
I get tired of hearing questions that just don't make sense.
What kind of questions?
Like, oh, did you know lasagna before you came here? Oh, your English is so good. Where did you learn your English? I'm like, I spoke English my entire life. Like, what are you saying? But yeah.
They said people were nice, but they weren't really nice. All these kind of little things that were annoying, but sometimes it would slip into something more than just ignorance, into prejudice and bigotry.
I've heard people say that, like, especially when we are in a group, that we are intimidating. I don't know, even like on campus, that's what has been said. So it's almost like, I just don't know how to describe it. It's like the people, like, I don't know if they want to feel comfortable around us, or if they just have accepted the fact that these people are not from here and they'll never be from here, and we don't have to, like, be nice or anything around them. We don't have to feel comfortable around them. I don't know. It's just very strange.
You know, I think there are these instances of ignorance, and then there's instances of a little bit of prejudice and bigotry, and then, you know, occasionally just outside, you know, racism as well. That I picked up a couple times when I was riding. I remember I was at this rest stop, and this old guy was telling a pretty crude racist joke about black men to a highway worker. They both laughed, and you know, occasionally you'll see, you know, a Confederate flag flying next to right next to the American flag and a Trump 2020 flag, and sort of these moments of racism, but also just ignorance and prejudice.
Nate, you say that there are moments when you're cycling and you're biking, and you describe it this way, as shifting into a lower gear, where you have this sense of another America, a wilder America. And it's in that world where the ghosts don't exist. What do you mean?
It's in – so what you're referring to is when I was riding through the Lemhi Valley and your phone drops out of cell service and, you know, I'm not picking up any – I don't have a radio with me. And I'm just cruising in a world of sagebrush and dead deer and flattened rattlesnakes. And I can feel everything slowing down. And I kind of say I shift into a lower gear or a slower gear, and into that wild, more rugged America where it feels like all of it doesn't even exist. You're just disconnected from news and from everything else like that. When you speak to folks who live out there in places like Tendoy, you know, they're worried about, yeah, I better make sure that I cut enough wood to heat the wood stove this winter. You know, I got to prepare for when the snow comes, things like that. It's different. And it feels much more grounded in a way that I think it's very easy nowadays with easy access to what people are saying about America to feel very ungrounded. And, I felt very grounded when I was separated from that. And I think there are people that feel very grounded when they don't pay attention to what's happening, outside of their town, and their community. It's something beautiful about that.
You describe what you're seeing and what you've seen on that trip as like a river between people that's getting wilder, you say, and more dangerous. What will a Biden win mean in real terms in these rural communities you visited? Do you think they'll settle in and just acknowledge that this might now be the new reality, or are you expecting maybe something more reactionary, more concerning than the time, for example, when Barack Obama was president? That is, has the rhetoric that they're hearing from Fox News and other places, is that going to make them act any differently? What do you think?
I mean, I don't want to paint a broad brush. I'm sure that there are folks that are just going to go on with their lives. For sure. I bet a lot of people will just go on with their lives. I think that there are a handful of people that I spoke with that believe that we slip into a socialist country, into a communist or Marxist country. I remember I was in this ghost town, essentially, of Jeffrey City, Wyoming, and I was talking with this guy, an artist, and he was showing me around his studio, and he showed me this one painting that his neighbor had made. And it was of these very pale, naked people walking down a road, being marched down, you know, soldiers with guns, watching them in this very dark post-apocalyptic skyline and everything else like that. And it was titled Utopia. And the artist had created it as a comment on Democrats leading this country towards communism and socialism and everyone turning into sheep. And so I think that fear is very palpable in some places. I don't see somebody just saying, well, Trump lost. I'm going to pull down my flag, I guess, and just put it away now. You know, I think that there's going to be, especially with the race being as close as it is, and how much disinformation and misinformation has already been sowed, and the groundwork's already been laid out. I've just been watching a lot of Fox News lately and to see how they're going to play it, because I think how Fox plays it is going to be how some people react to it. And I think that'll tell us, you know, is this going to be seen as a legitimate win, or is this going to be seen as the president wants it to be seen as voter fraud? And I think that we will see, I don't know. I don't want to make predictions. I think that there are people who believe that we're going to see civil unrest and violent revolution. Whether or not they actually act out on that, or whether it's just something you say, you know, I'm not one to decide that. But I know that people having that conversation very openly, and enough people having that conversation very openly, was pretty shocking to me.
So which is the one that stays with you, that concern that, man, this could get really ugly, or the part that, hey, this is really cool, people can set aside their differences and work together? Like, which one feels the strongest right now? Which impulse for you?
I'm going to go back to Dave in Ledore and talking about how his community, despite everything, has always felt like this disjointed family that comes together. There's a reason he didn't give me his last name. We were kind of standing there talking. He's one of the few people that doesn't like Trump in a sea of Trump supporters. And we're standing outside of the post office, and this beat up pickup truck pulls up. Guy gets out.
He walks into the post office. Dave says hi, but the guy completely ignores him. And that's why Dave only gives me his first name. He's worried that people might hear this interview and maybe they'll stop being so nice during a snowstorm or a power outage. Because he's an outlier in a sea of Trump supporters.
This place could not be more Trump if everyone was flying a blue Trump 2020 flag.
And I think that is becoming a more real fear, especially when we look at how communities are reacting to the pandemic. I think that this disinformation is starting to filter down into a hyper-local level. You know, up here in Montana, we had an entire team of public health officers resign in a small rural county because they weren't getting the support they needed, getting shouted down during county commissioner meetings. And so I think we're starting to see that fray in these smaller communities. That worries me. And I think it worries, you know, guys like Dave.
Nate Hedgie, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Nate Hedgie, he's a reporter for the Mountain West News Bureau, host of the podcast Facing West, and we have a link to that and to his blog from his travels on our website, radiowest.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Every weekday, you tune in to KUER for engaging, high-quality news from NPR. On Saturdays and Sundays, you'll find that same kind of reporting on Weekend Edition, All Things Considered, and our top-of-the-hour newscasts. Weekends are also your chance to explore, uncover fascinating stories on This American Life and Snap Judgment. Feed your curiosity with Planet Money and discover the lighter side of the week's news with Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Check out what's in store this weekend at KUER.org/schedule.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We were looking for someone centered in the rural West to offer some final thoughts on this election season. So we reached out to Hal Herring. Hal is a conservation journalist, a hunter, an angler, passionate about public land and wild spaces. And he, too, has been trying to really understand the appeal of a man like Donald Trump in rural places. And here's what he's figured out. Herring says Trump is the punk rock president for mainstream people.
The idea in rural America, and I'll speak mostly to the West, yeah, is that we were being condescended to, that we were deplorables. And all of a sudden we went from being deplorables to being the ones flipping the bird. And with some clout, I think it's imaginary clout. You know, I think so much of this is so much of a WWE wrestling match that we are all taking seriously. You know, will Stone Cold Steve Austin finally beat the Undertaker, right?
Yeah.
And the fate of our nation is at stake in this WWE match, right? Which it's sad, but it's also very entertaining when you have been called a deplorable and people have condescended to you to suddenly be the ones driving the big truck. I don't think that's a healthy state of affairs for our nation. But I do understand it on a psychological and personal level.
Well, one thing you said, I think this is interesting. You've said that the obliviousness on the left might just be more dangerous than the disinformation on the right. Talk a little bit about that, just because it seems like what you're saying is that there's a real lack of empathy or a real lack of humility on the left. And maybe that is, you know, whatever happens in the election or the outcome after all of this. And maybe that needs to happen. There needs to be a kind of a new way of thinking on the left.
I think there definitely needs to be a new way of thinking on the left. The obliviousness, I liken it to like a school teacher, you know, in his or her 50s, who's teaching a class of 6-year-olds. They're not really listening to what the 6-year-olds are saying when they're arguing about where they want their desks. Right?
Yeah.
It's like the left in America has assumed a power that it does not have. And it's reminded in every election that this power is ephemeral and it's not there. And no matter whether you're right, being right doesn't mean you get to make the rules. Being correct doesn't mean that everybody is going to agree with you and do what you say. And in that way, being condescending, you end up losing. I'm not going to call it the moral high ground. That's not what it is. But you assume a high ground that you occupy, which other people don't recognize at all.
So you're thinking that Democrats, like, let's be specific about a couple of things. You're saying that one thing that might make sense for Democrats is to show a little bit more flexibility on attacking the Second Amendment. This is something you've talked about. And I wonder if you also think in the same way, the same kind of thinking should be applied to, you know, other kinds of policies.
I do. Before I get into that, though, I would say that someone like Senator John Tester here in Montana or our Governor Bullock, they've already had that. They figured that out a long time ago.
Yeah.
I mean, they occupy that space. The national party could learn from them. Talking about the punk rock president. I mean, I'm an older person, right? I'm done with the mohawks and the rock throwing and setting fire to somebody's mailbox or whatever. Right. I don't really think that's a viable way to run a country. I guess I'm a little too serious or whatever to enjoy the president's Twitter feed, for instance. But we do have a moderate Democrat party here in Montana from which the national party could learn. And when I look at Joe Biden's website, people don't want what they're selling. So it's not their priorities.
Okay, so we've talked a little bit about the Democratic Party. What about Republicans? You've said that something has to be done to normalize the Republican Party. Explain what you mean.
Well, it seems to me in my lifetime, which I sort of became an adult during Ronald Reagan, there's been a headlong rush in the Republican Party to become more and more simply, one, it's oligarchical, but two, it doesn't have any solutions for anything. It's now, because in the absence of all concrete ideas, it has become a maelstrom of abstraction. I mean, why are there so many millions of Americans convinced that the way forward is to discredit our institutions and burn down, metaphorically speaking, all the things that have delivered us this sort of functioning democratic republic that we live in? I don't understand that. But I do know that in the absence of concrete ideas and this kind of default to plutocracy, the Republican Party has become like punk rock. Anything goes.
You mentioned you don't think much of what Joe Biden has proposed is going to appeal to rural Westerners. How are they going to react to a Joe Biden presidency? And do you think that, I mean, this is one thing that Nate Hedges has talked about in his podcast, that he's worried that it's possible there might be some violence. There might be something kind of extreme that happens as a reaction. What do you think?
Well, for one, that's too much conjecture for today.
Yeah.
On my part. I mean, living in the West, having gone to the Bundy occupation of the Malheur Refuge and having covered a lot of this stuff for a long time and had the, you know, have to deal with these armed, they call themselves protesters, but, you know, it's a mob. I mean, when you have people standing around dressed in soldier suits, brandishing automatic or semi-automatic weapons and wearing pistols and having and extra ammo and stuff, I mean, the chance of violence is, of course, there because you have all the tools in place, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we have no idea what's going to happen with whether people will accept this or not. And what would that look like? You know, like how much power do these 30,000 or so people around the West, I mean, what risks do they want to take, right? Like, I just don't, I think that's conjecture. I think it might all calm down or it could all blow up. And, yeah. You know, I don't know what that would look like. I don't think anybody does.
Yeah. This was interesting. You said that you thought the future of public lands and environment lies in the Republican Party. In what way? Was it go back to what you were saying earlier?
I'm sorry to say that. And I wouldn't have said that before the Republicans started winning so consistently. If the Republicans are going to be holding the power and many, many, many Republican voters love to fish, they love to hunt, they love to camp, they love to take their kids horsepacking across the Wind Rivers. If these people want clean air and clean water, then that party, which is holding the power, has to be dealt with. They have to be our hope. And I'm not sure that's impossible. Some people say I'm a Pollyanna on this.
Nate Hedgie said that one of the things that drew him out on a bicycle to go around, you know, up and down the Continental Divide to talk to people was this idea that people were not putting themselves in places to have these conversations. And it makes it more difficult, obviously, you know, circumstantially because of COVID. But I wonder if what you think about that. You have plenty of conversations with people you agree with and you don't. And I wonder, could the West in some way, and maybe I'll speak to the Pollyanna side of you for a minute, could it be a model for healing in some way? Like, will Western communities who have to rely on community and other people, who have to talk to people they don't always agree with, could in that way, could it be a model in some way to help heal the country, if that's even possible?
It could be. That model is so much in question when you have the world of the internet connecting people with more radical views and disinformation.
Yeah.
When you're sandbagging in a flood, for instance, with folks, you don't talk politics. You protect your town. And that model would be a wonderful model to go forward in healing, because I do feel like we're under an enormous stress and duress and threat here in America. But it's really working against the bubble of especially right wing disinformation. I mean, you know, I run into people who are otherwise very reasonable folks who could tell you the most outlandish conspiracy theories. But it's working against us to have so many people within these bubbles in their home, at their computer, receiving mega loads of disinformation.
Nate says that, like that twisting plastic flag that he found while he was on his bike ride.
That's a great story.
Right? And he says the country's kind of broken down and lost. What do you think? Is he right?
I think the country is so polarized right now that there's two different radically varying visions for the future, neither one of which is viable. So the question is whether we can step across this division enough to create a vision of a future. We don't have to agree on it, but at least we're not ready to go to war with each other over it. And those commonalities probably do exist. But again, I mean, I can't tell you, and Nate spoke to this, how many times I'm a comments junkie on the internet. And I run into these comments where they just say that there will be no peace until these people who hate America, all of them Democrats, you know, are wiped out. And I don't think you can build anything from that. It's not, I can't remember what you call that, but it's a winner take all deal. I think that's going to happen like Civil War? I doubt it, because there's too many people are busy. They're raising kids. They're going to volleyball games and tournaments in Fort Benton, Montana. They're trying to keep the lights on and pay for their health insurance.
Yeah. Well, maybe people distracted with real life will save us as a country.
Wouldn't that be nice? I really don't understand where we all get so much time to entertain all these notions and to post them on Facebook.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me that people have these enormous abundance of time to pursue the most outlandish theories about why the other side is awful.
Hal Herring, he's a journalist and contributor to Field and Stream magazine, joined us from his office in rural Montana. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Ivana Martinez, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.